für Robotik hier am Institut für Robotik und kognitive Systeme. Und ich freue mich sehr, dass Sie hier sind und dass ich hier eingeladen wurde, einen Vortrag zu halten über unsere Arbeit. Und wenn es Ihnen nichts ausmacht, werde ich diesen Vortrag auf Englisch halten, weil wir in der Robotik bevorzugt immer Englisch sprechen. Ansonsten müssten Sie sich jetzt melden. Well, I will try to speak loud enough such that you can even hear me in the last row. Let me know if you can't understand me. Ask questions whenever you want. We are here in a very relaxed atmosphere. It's late at night. Usually people go out at that time. And we sit here and we try to understand what is going on in robotics. And it's written here already, robotics rocks. That's our driving statement here. Now, what inspires me, what motivates me in doing my research is that for me, humanoid robots are among the most complex machine on this planet. And understanding how to program them, how to teach them, how to train them to learn skills is really fascinating for me. And you see here different examples. This is the ICAP robot. It's one of the most complex humanoid robots developed here in Europe. It has 53 degrees of freedom, many sensors, super expensive sensors. It has a sensor suite, so it can feel, has the sense of touch. It has optical stereo vision system, and so on. You see here a very famous example of from Boston Dynamics, where they test here a suite for chemical weapons. You see here two other humanoid robots that we usually use it for teaching. So if you study with us, if you work with us together, it might easily happen that you will get in touch with these two toyish-like robots. But even with these simple systems, you can learn a lot. Now, what is a humanoid robot? In the end, a humanoid robot is anything that has the form or the function of a human. And that's a very broad formalization. Now, this is for sure a humanoid robot, but it has no legs, so it's a mobile platform. The advantage is that the control is way easier. The major drawback is it wouldn't enter this room that easily. It wouldn't be able to climb up these stairs. So legs are very important for humanoid robots. Without legs, you can't interact in a natural fashion with our human beings in our everyday life. This is a well-known humanoid robot that's called Baxter. Actually, this robot is nowadays not anymore sold. It's replaced by another robot called Franka. But there is a continuous development. Here you see the most commonly used robots in research labs. These robots are developed by KUKA. These are lightweight arms. Lightweight means they have 7 kilograms or 14 kilograms. They're super fast, very precise, very expensive. But we love them because it's easy to work with them as a researcher. Now, this is, in some way, also a humanoid robot. It's an autonomous car. Might react, understand scenes, reason about possible decisions in certain situations. So what I want to give you home as a statement is that robotics in the end is a great research field, but also a great job opportunity. If you study that topic, you will have different options and highly changing robotic field. You will earn a lot if you study that. That are some prognoses here from 2015, I think. These are numbers, how many industries use robots, and this number is exponentially growing. So I received last week an update on these numbers. I can tell you that robotics market is growing on the private toy market side, but also on the industrial side. So these are not so important numbers. So in the end, for me, a humanoid robot can interact with us humans in our normal environment, not in some special lab environment. It needs some form of autonomy, skills that can be learned through self-training. This is very important. So this is the key difference between AI systems that might have been trained once, applied to your smartphone, and then they don't collect any data anymore. They don't adapt. It's a static system. So autonomous learning is the key for robots. Of course, many of your applications that use neural networks, they still collect your data and adapt to your particular behavior. But this is another thing. Now, we need to reason about the world to create actions. And for that, we need abstractions. That's crucial. So, very interesting is that the challenges in understanding these humanoid robots is now converging with understanding human beings. And the reason is that if we look at the human organism, we have about 700 muscles, about 100 joints, depending how we count them, like eyebrows are not counted here. We have about 100 million photoreceptors in our eyes. We have about 100 touch receptive cells in our fingertips, in a single fingertip. If we look at the humanoid robot, I think that particular example here, it has already 53 degrees of freedom, and this is version 1. Nowadays, version 3 is sold, which is even more expensive, but also more capable. So I would love to get one of those robots. We have, in all your smartphones, you have higher resolution camera systems than we in our optical system. This robot here has more than 2,300 tactile sensors on this blue skin. So the sensors are very interesting. So you can now start to interact with a human teacher by touching the robot. And these touch senses can be used as input and could trigger different actions from the robot system. Or you can simply measure how much force you apply to the system. Therefore, tactile sensing is very crucial. Now, whatever I do, it's more than just training a machine. It's more than just robotics. It's a mix between different fields. And these fields are this behavior learning, motor skill learning in human beings. It's, of course, robotics as a core field, but also machine learning. So it connects these three research domains. And that's very interdisciplinary, and transferring knowledge and results between these domains is very motivating. Well, I give you now probably the quickest robotics history review you could ever see, because this is very short. So I start with most of the historical reviews with Kara Capek, who used the word robot in his play, in his theatre play, for a machine in the end. Isaac Asimov developed his three famous rules that should prevent robots from taking over the human society. So this was very shocking in the end. And also nowadays we have strong discussions on media about the singularity that AI will take over or will exceed human intelligence. And it's interesting that most robotics researchers are a little bit more pessimistic in that sense, because we work actually with every day with these systems, and we are not that optimistic that we will easily develop a machine that can learn as fast as a 10 months old child. So we're still far, far away. But there is some consensus, and the consensus is that at some point a machine will be capable of learning like a human, but we don't know when. So, well, okay, let's look at one famous result that's from Stanford research, Stanford University. That's from 1968. That's the Shaky robot. And already back then, this robot had basic planning, navigation, manipulation skills implemented and learning. And since that, we still do research in the same directions. We use maybe more expensive, more precise hardware. It's different. But the tasks are still the same. So the skills the robot have to fulfill is still the same. And that's really astonishing, because at that time, people believed that within the next 10 years, robotics will revolutionize our world. And also nowadays, AI will change everything. So we have always these strong statements in media. But in the end, if we look back into the history, it takes way more longer. It's more complicated than expected. It's not so easy. Well, back to humanoid systems. Here is the first humanoid robot developed by Hiro Kato. And this was a real milestone in terms of mechanic construction and complexity of this system. And whenever you look at the walking machine like that, you will see that these robots still have a very strange walking pattern. It's not comparable to humans. And the main difference is that the knees are always bended. So, and the problem is, it's a mathematical problem. If you fully flex your knee, you enter into singularities. You have singularities in the dynamics equations. And therefore, the knees are always bended in these robotic systems to have a stable, controllable system. But it's not as energy efficient as we humans. If we, as humans, walk, this changes, of course. Now, this was a strange way of walking, but you see, there's a difference between what we as engineers develop and what we as human beings developed through evolution within 100 millions of years. And it's interesting to understand that. Now, of course, Honda was or is still a very big player in humanoid robotics. They still have one of the biggest humanoid robots research labs. We collaborate with Honda a lot. And their Asimo, shown here at the end, is one of the most famous humanoid robots. But they have a long history, and they started in 1982 to develop this first lower limb robotic system. Now, here's a more recent example. This is the ICAP robot, and this is the final result of a project where a human being helped this robot how to stand up, and it integrated pre-learning through reinforcement learning. It had this human-robot interaction. It used force control. It used the tactile skin. It used measurements about the human center of mass from a kinetic sensor. So only by observing the human being, we estimated the center of mass of this subject. And with that, we could correct the poses of the robot. So it had many, many puzzle pieces that were linked together here. And that's necessary for human robots. Well, this is now already 1.5 years old, this movie. But that, of course, shocked the whole research community because we work so hard in developing smart machines, and then Boston Dynamics presents such amazing result. So this is the first robot that can perform a backflip. And 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, they released a video where the same robot was doing parkour. You probably know that. So it's amazing what they can do. The sad thing, the bad news is that we don't know what they actually do because they don't publish it. It's military funded. So we have to do it ourselves and do the research. There's no other way. But it's impressive what you can do if you take a lot of money, if you use a lot of money, and if you have the engineers and the equipment and the hardware. Well, let's look at the different example where two robot arms are cooperating with each other, and this often very simple everyday task. So they try to untwist this lid from a flask. And for that, this lid has to be turned. And at some point, the robot will probe if the lid can be opened already or not. And that involves already a very crucial sense of force. And it's not that easy to do that. But it's for us, it's very simple and straightforward. But for machines and for engineers to develop a learning system that acquires the necessary knowledge, that's complicated in the end. So here's another example where you see the same robot performing two motions. They're almost equal. Only the final pose of this arm is different. In one movie, it was aligned horizontally. In the other one, it was not constrained at all. And that was a proof of a concept of a very human-like behavior. We as humans, we only control those dimensions that are really necessary to solve a task. What does that mean? So if I move my arm in some way and I try to reach for some object, then I don't care about my elbow. I do whatever feels right at the moment. I care about my end effector. And in this test, we developed an algorithm that at some point cared about the end effector or horizontal position, and or it didn't. And it was only one scalar that we changed. And it's a very powerful approach. And we could reproduce that behavior. But it's important to know, whenever you learn a skill, you will only focus about those dimensions that are really necessary. If you play tennis, you don't care too much about the swinging motion. You care about the impact forces and the final position where you will hit the ball. Of course, I'm not an expert. An expert will care about all the micro details, but I won't. Well, let's move on. So, this is now a little bit mean. These are results of my colleagues. No. So these are the best robotic teams in the world, and these are failures that happened during the DARPA rescue challenge. So, I give you now one insider story about the MIT team here, which won the competition. They failed in the last driving task where the robot had to drive a truck, and it did a perfect job. It drove this truck, but in the end, when the robot had to climb out of the car again, they forgot to switch on one of the motors in the hip. And what happened was, of course, the robot fell. But it's a complex system, and simply switching on one switch, forgetting about one simple thing. And it looks so stupid, because we as humans, we would say, oh, this is not an intelligent machine. Yeah, but the key is, it's a complex system, and if you forget to switch on one single puzzle piece, it will fail. So, coming back to learning motor skills, here's an example where I teach this ICAP robot how to stack caps. It's a very simple game for children in the end. And I used here a self-made sensor glove, which had here flex sensors. They changed the resistive value based on the flexion of this stripe. And with that, I controlled the fingers. And you see here optical markers, and they were used to move the wrist of the robot arm. So, in the end, it's like remote control of a remote car, but using some more complicated sensors and optical systems. And what I did is I demonstrated twice the same motion, more or less. So it was a real experiment. And then I learned a model, a probabilistic model of these motions, and the robot could, in principle, execute the same thing now a million times. And that's interesting because it took me maybe 20 seconds to show the robot something, and now it could memorize that knowledge and do it forever. So this is a very efficient way in training a robot how to do something. The alternative is to program something that makes sense for industrial tasks where I need to have control over everything, and learning has some source of uncertainty, because you never know if a teacher interacts badly with a system, it could teach a robot very bad thing. So industry is very careful about that. But here, for us, it's important to solve tasks, not a million times, but maybe 20, 100 times, where programming would be too time consuming. Instead, we use machine learning to teach a robot quickly a task, must not be super perfect and precise, but in the end, we can execute it and work with the system. Yes? Ja, also die Methode kann das. Also Fragen auf Deutsch sind super in Ordnung, überhaupt kein Problem. Ich spreche jetzt kein Deutsch, ich bin Österreicher, aber es funktioniert. Wer bei mir Master- oder Bachelorarbeit schreibt, muss auch Österreichisch lernen. Das ist Pflicht. Also die Position an sich ist hier vorgegeben. Man kann aber sehr leicht über visuelle Systeme die Objekte, Konturen berechnen, die Position herausrechnen und dann adaptieren. Also das ist ein kleiner Trick im Endeffekt. So, to nail down what I'm actually doing in the lab. I'm researching in two directions. The first one is, how can I teach a robot motor skills? And motor skills is everything that has something to do with movement, motion. And the second thing is, I'm interested in cognitive abilities, reasoning, deduction, deciding among different actions which one is the best, give me a certain context, for instance, some visual observations, or you're running in a hallway and suddenly a door flips and opens and you have to decide quickly, go to the left or to the right. So for that, I'm developing algorithms that are super efficient and fast. That's my research. Now, to give you a motivation to visit my course, which I teach together with Niels Rottmann, who is sitting also here. So I'm teaching an undergraduate course on humanoid robotics, which is probably the only one all over Germany that covers all these topics here in an undergraduate course. Usually these topics are very advanced and only for master students they are taught in other universities. But for us, it was important to give the robotics students and also the informatics students the chance to get easily and early in touch with robots and also understand what are the necessary components. What do I need? If I want to work with such a complex system, what do I need to understand? What do I need to learn? And here we go all around this loop and we touch all these topics. Of course, we don't go into detail as much as we would do it in a master course. But we give the students a very good overview about what is robotics, what could I do with that if I would do a master in robotics and work at a company. And if you're interested in that, ask Niels or me, visit our course. Well, I will talk a little bit about movement representations now. I'll give you some insights about the complexity of simple motions. And you see here an example where this robot has to measure the paint thickness, for instance, of this car part. And for that, it has this predefined path and has to follow this path. Now, for following this path, I can use some feedback control strategies. But for generating this trajectory here, I might use data points. But this is highly inefficient because you have to store all these points in your memory. There are alternative representations. I will talk about one, about a probabilistic one. Now I talk about these movements here. So classical naive approach is to store everything in matrices in your memory. But that would easily explode. And if you would have some realistic data set, which I used here in an experiment where I measured the human motion during posture control, I used here 70 markers. And I collected some data. And if I would use the naive approach, I would need to store 3 gigabytes and you would need 3 gigabytes of memory for movements of only 1 second. And 1 second is not really enough to interact with us humans in an everyday-like fashion. So that won't scale. For sure not. Well, we have something in robotics called movement primitives that tries to represent complex motions using only a few numbers. And here are some desirable features. So they need to be compact, they need to be smooth, and so on. We need to learn them through our training methods, our favorite ones. And in the end, we want to compose very complex stuff by sequencing these simple primitives, we call it. They are like Lego bricks. And if you use multiple of these bricks together, you build a nice, beautiful house. So this is the same story, but for movements. And in the end, we would like to work with very noisy data from our sensors. So these are our requirements, and for that, we have very nice models, and one of them is based on probability theory. So whatever you learn in stochastic is not useless. We use it a lot in robotics. So this is a conditional distribution that could be used, for instance, to answer a very simple question. if you want to reach for an object in a shelf, but it's very far away, and you have to lean on the table to prevent yourself from falling. Then you could ask a question, if I reach for the milk on the right side, where would I touch the table? Or if you reach for your beans on the left side, whatever, will this position change? So this is a very simple question. And you could use this condition distribution, where this variable A here is the position of the beans or milk, and variable B is the position of your left hand on the table. So it can be very realistic in the end. Now, the basic concept is a conditional probability. For motions are smooth trajectories. So they are a little bit more complex than just milk and position on a table. For that, we need some smarter models. I will finish that one here for sure. So if you start with some basis function, we call them, that are Lego bricks, and we multiply them by some magic numbers that we can learn, we can generate any nonlinear function. That's shown here. So with this simple model, I can generate any nonlinear movement trajectory of my robot system. The only thing that I need is some basis function that are always the same, and I need to know how to tune this vector here, or this set of numbers. So I have six numbers to generate a very complex motion. And that's what I mean on previous slides by compact. Well, a single movement trajectory is not enough to control a robot with 53 motors. So you need 53 control signals. And what we do is we align them, these individual motor signals, along a long vector. And if we do that, we can use again stochastic probability theory, Gaussian distributions in this case, to encode not only a single movement like shown here, but a whole distribution of movements. And that's a very powerful thing, because now I have the correlation here between individual motors. And this correlation in the end is used to answer the question, if I touch the reach for the milk, is this movement now correlated with a certain movement of my left hand where I touched the table? And that's exploited here. We skip the math. That would help you to fall asleep tonight. So you can have these slides, of course, yeah, for later. I prefer to show you some more movies before we conclude. We had that. This one is interesting. Here you see the subject reaching for some targets. And this screen was very far away, and these sportive students were very tall, so for them the task was easier than for me. But they had to lean on this table here to reach for this target. And the target was at different positions here on the screen. And then we measured the position on this table that they reached for. And in the end, I used this model that I just presented to ask to predict where the subject will touch the screen, whatever the trunk movement was, or whatever the left hand did. Yes, there's a question.
Wird jetzt bei dem Roboter, wird er rechtshändig, linkshändig und sowas an und Ei gemacht, oder würde jetzt wirklich wahrscheinlichkeitsmäßig einfach sagen, das rechte ist in die rechte Hand und das linke ist in die linke Hand?
Ja, das war ein anderes Experiment. In dem Fall war das beschränkt. Die rechte Hand wurde nur zum Erreichen von den Objekten verwendet und die linke nur zum Balancieren mit dem Tisch, also zum Abstützen. Aber man könnte natürlich auch hier diese Unterscheidung treffen und dann sagen, dass solche Arbeiten gibt es auch, je nachdem, wo das Center of Mass sich befinden wird, man macht eine Prädiktion, je nachdem, was man für eine Bewegung machen muss, wird es eher Sinn machen, die linke Hand zum Abstützen nehmen oder die rechte, so wie wir Menschen auch intuitiv uns reflexartig abstützen. Und dieses Reflexartige ist dieses Abrufen von Wissen, wo muss ich mich abstützen, in welcher Situation. Gut, es gibt noch viel, viel mehr zu erzählen, aber das werden wir jetzt da überspringen und ein bisschen abkürzen. Wir verwenden diese Modelle auch für interessante Fragen, wie zum Beispiel hier relevanter in der medizinischen Informatik. Wir haben ja untersucht, English was the topic. So, back to English. We investigated if subject had a knee issue or not. And for that, we used a data set of 20 subjects. 10 of them had some knee issues, and 10 others were very healthy. And the data was required in such a way that they were sitting on a chair and they had to get up. And if you have some knee pain, you do it in a different way, this motion. And we measured here the EMG signals and also the kinematics of this subject. And we used this probabilistic model to predict if they have feel pain or not. And the result is shown here, that classical approaches, they predict with about 60-70% correctly if you have this knee problem or not. And with our approach, we could end up reaching this correctness rate of 90%. Well, this is not only a single experiment, but it demonstrates that this probabilistic approach is capable in the end to work with very noisy data. And you have to know that EMG are among the most noisy sensors that we work with, even noisier than any vision sensor. So, and therefore, probabilistic models have some benefits. So, and that's really helpful also for other domains, not only for robotics. This is now for medical robotics. Different thing. Well, if you're interested in reading more about these topics, look at my webpage. It's called rob.ailab.science. And visit my course if you want to know more about all the other things I haven't talked about. With that, I would like to thank you for your attention. Yeah. This is my last slide now. That's the trick. Are there any further questions? Yeah. Well, talk to my colleague Niels if you want later. He will be here until 3 in the night. I don't know. One question, yeah.
Dieser Roboter, die in diesem Wettbewerb gezeigt wurden, die diese Aufgaben machen mussten, war diese Bewegung, die Aufgaben, die Lösung der Aufgaben auch AI-gesteuert oder war da eine Person mit der Fernbedienung?
Ja, das ist eine sehr gute Frage und im Endeffekt war ein Forschungsziel von dieser Rescue League, die Daten von diesen Fernsteuerungsmechanismen zu komprimieren. Weil man davon ausgeht, wenn man jetzt in Katastrophengebieten oder in eingestürzten Atomkraftwerken Roboter einsetzt, dass dort die Telekommunikation nicht so gut funktionieren wird. Und deshalb wird die Bandbreite in dieser Rescue League beschränkt. Und dann ist es nicht nur AI, Machine Learning und so, es ist wirklich auch Signalverarbeitung, Datenkompression, es ist AI kommt dann ins Spiel, wenn es darum geht, möglichst viel Autonomie für einfache Aufgaben direkt am Roboter zu berechnen. Das heißt, der Roboter selbst schlägt schon vor, er könnte jetzt das Steuerrad zum Aufdrehen des Wassers hier angreifen, hier und hier. Und der Operator überträgt dann nur per Mausklick, nein, nimm diese Position, das ist das Beste jetzt in deiner Situation. Und die Bewegung selbst macht der Roboter dann wieder autonom. Das muss nicht für jede Millisekunde übertragen werden und ferngesteuert werden. Also es ist eine Mischung, es ist recht spannend und es gibt sehr viele Möglichkeiten, da in solchen Teams auch mitzuarbeiten.
Für welche Leistung braucht so ein Roboter, um komplexe Modelle zu berechnen?
Ich kann ein konkretes Beispiel geben. Also dieser ICAP-Roboter, der läuft mit zwei Standard-PCs, würde ich jetzt sagen, die wir vor ein paar Jahren gekauft haben, aber es sind schon wirkliche zwei mit Solid-State-Disk, sehr schnellen Grafikkarten, 8 Cores und so Sachen. 34 GB RAM brauchen die schon mindestens. Also man muss schon ein bisschen Geld in die Hand nehmen. Und dann hat man zwei so große Kisten, die man mit Rollwagen hinten nachschieben muss, wenn der Roboter dann wirklich läuft. Also ja, Autonomie ist im Kommen. Ja.
Sie haben gesagt, es gibt eine Statistik gezeigt, wo Roboterverteilung in einzelnen Nationen gehen muss. Und dann hat auch schon relativ weit gehoben. Das habe ich jetzt nicht gewundert. Wie groß ist da der Einfluss der Automobilindustrie?
Ja, also relativ weit oben. Man hat jetzt die Zahlen nicht lang genug, glaube ich, untersuchen können. Ich habe zu schnell weitergeschaltet. Es war jetzt auf 10.000 Industriemitarbeiter kommen 100 Roboter in Japan. Ja? Das waren so circa die nur Zahlen. Das verdoppelt sich jetzt, hat sich jetzt verdoppelt und so weiter. Also die Gefahr ist natürlich da, dass man Arbeitsplätze durch diese Automatisierungsmöglichkeit ersetzt. Das passiert auch, das hat es auch immer gegeben. Man schafft aber auch andere Arbeitsplätze, wenn die Frage in die Richtung geht. Also man muss sich das so überlegen. Wir brauchen dann natürlich spezialisiertere Arbeitskräfte, die dann diese Robotersteuerung übernehmen können und nur noch diese High-Level-Kommandos übergeben, aber jetzt nicht mehr selber einprogrammieren müssen, wo der Roboter zu jedem Zeitpunkt sein muss. Sondern die müssen dann mit diesen Lernalgorithmen umgehen lernen. Na, freut mich. Vielen Dank, dass Sie da waren. Viel Spaß heute Abend noch. Robotics Rocks!